Hey, hi, I'm Alan, one of the elected trainee committee members and also the podcast lead for the association. So continuing our annual Congress 2023 series, I'm delighted to be currently joined by Dr. Rob Fleming. Rob is a specialist anaesthetist at Sherwood Forest Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust. For any anaesthetist who spends any time on Twitter, well, I suppose now called X, you probably will have seen Rob discussing SS doctors and alternative career pathways, which is exactly what we will be discussing today on this podcast. So thanks for joining me, Rob.
Thank you very much for having me, Alan.
We're here today to talk about SAS anaesthetists, SAS careers and alternative training pathways. Before I became an anaesthetist, and admittedly before I saw your tweets, I had no idea what a SAS doctor actually was. Would you be able to just briefly outline what it is and what the difference between a specialty doctor and a specialist is?
It would be an absolute pleasure to do so. Firstly, I'd probably say that your lack of knowledge is absolutely normal, and this is a big part of why I do what I do in the world. I genuinely believe that by raising a little bit of awareness, I might empower people to make career choices that suit them rather than career choices that they feel they have to make. And I think that's a positive thing at the moment. So since the dawning of the NHS, for decades and decades and decades, there have been doctors who were not consultants, not GPs, and not in formal training programmes. These doctors have always existed. And for the majority of the history of the NHS, there have been national contracts for that work, and those are the SAS contracts. Some SAS contracts from history that you may be aware of, between about 1988 and 2008, the two SAS contracts that the majority of doctors were employed on were the staff grade contract, which was less senior, and the associate specialist contract, which was the senior role. And from those two contracts, from staff and associate specialist, we originally got the term SAS or SAS. Both of those contracts closed to new entry in 2008, and then we had 13 years where there was only one SAS contract that was open to new entry, and that was the specialty doctor role. So the specialty doctor role has been around since 2008. An awful lot of us felt very strongly about the idea that we should restore a senior role. We felt that there was something missing, because it should be normal while working as a specialty doctor to progress and develop and to move from more direct supervision to less direct supervision and to independence and to broaden yourself into non-clinical roles. And we felt there was a need for a role that recognised that. So a lot of organisations, including the Association of Anaesthetists and the Royal College of Anaesthetists, lobbied for the restoration of the associate specialist role. And we kind of got what we asked for, but not quite. So as part of the 2021 SAS contract reform, we got a new senior contract, which is the specialist role. So the two contracts are broadly the same in terms of how they are structured. They're both, you have a contractual right to a job plan, you have a contractual right to SPA time, but they have different eligibility because they target completely different parts of the workforce. So the specialty doctor role is the less senior role and the specialist role is the senior role.
Okay. And how did you end up becoming a SAS doctor? How has the move away from what is traditionally a formal training pathway suited your own career?
So as an individual, I would say this is very definitely a conscious choice. I like to think I was ahead of the game in that I was a fairly miserable trainee. So around about 2010, 2011, I was in an anaesthetic training programme. I had had up to that point, a very conventional career. I had graduated medical school, I completed a foundation programme, and I'd entered into what was then run through training in anaesthesia at ST1. And I completed 4 years as a specialty trainee without any major hiccups. I passed my exams, I completed my modules as they were then, and I made progress. And I started to become unhappy with the constant rotation. I started to become unhappy with the time pressure and the critical nature of having to achieve the next hurdle at the next defined point. And I had a few upsetting experiences at work, as we often do. And I met my wife and started a family. So I had kind of push factors and pull factors. There were aspects of being a trainee that were making me unhappy, and I recognised that there was a way that I could have a career as an anaesthetist without necessarily staying in a training programme. I had been very fortunate to meet some inspirational SAS anaesthetists on my journey, and I saw a way that I could continue to be an anaesthetist without being in a formal training programme. And at that point in my career, it seemed like the most natural choice in the world to resign my training number. So that's 11 years ago for me now.
Mm-hmm. You've talked a bit about difficulties with rotational training, difficulties some people have with things like starting a family, which obviously can be quite difficult with the training requirements we have. Considering these, what kind of people do you think would benefit most from embarking down an SAS career?
And see, what I would like, I think in an ideal world, if I have a utopian vision of the future, it would be that anyone could embark on an SAS career, that people who achieve the minimum requirements to be a specialty doctor, so that's 4 years postgraduate experience, two in anaesthesia, so anyone who's completed up to and including the end of CT2, either inside or outside of a formal training programme, might then have a choice. And my utopian vision would be that somebody who's got that level of experience could then decide what better suits their circumstances. And so for some people, progressing their career as a specialty doctor, either temporarily and then re-entering training down the line, or progressing their career primarily as a specialty doctor with the intention of becoming a specialist, or with somewhere down the line undertaking CESR and becoming a consultant without ever re-entering a formal training program, I would like it that people knew that these options were available to them and that all of these options were something that they could choose. I think in that situation, an awful lot of people might choose a career that looked different to what they think their career is going to look like. Mm-hmm. If you ask the typical British graduate what their career is supposed to look like, they'll describe something that looks a bit like progression from one stage of training into the next without ever pausing for breath. But we already know that that isn't the truth for the majority of people now. So foundation year 3 and year 4 years have become very normal. Years as a junior clinical fellow between stages of training have become very normal. Post-CCT fellowships or out-of-program experience have become very, very normal. And I would like to open up the conversation a little bit more so that people might choose to just not have a career that looks like that and to progress and develop within one organisation instead. And the people that it might suit are exactly the people that you might imagine. So anyone with caring responsibilities, anyone with a life outside of medicine that dictates that right now rotating every 3 to 6 months and trying to pass an exam every year possibly doesn't suit their current individual circumstances, I'd like to give people choice.
Exactly. You've briefly just touched upon the idea of an F3 or junior clinical fellow role. In terms of posts that sit outside of a formal training pathway, people are perhaps most familiar with the idea of an F3. Being a junior clinical fellow, or post-core training roles such as a senior clinical fellow. How do these differ from SAS contracts?
So you ask a fascinating question. So the trainee contract was negotiated for doctors who are in formal rotational training programmes. For doctors who are outside formal rotational training programmes, the nationally negotiated contract for the work are the SAS contracts. They are the specialty doctor contract and the specialist contract. The fact that at the moment we have more doctors on a non-standard contract that looks a bit like a trainee contract, rather than having lots of specialty doctors, troubles me a great deal. In fact, the precedent set by having such large numbers of doctors on non-standard, non-national terms and conditions of service, I think it would trouble a lot more people if they actually recognised that that was the situation. So the group you're describing, your F3s, F4s, junior clinical fellows, senior clinical fellows, also sometimes called trust doctors, trust grades, there are an awful lot of titles that get applied to these roles, are usually on a version of the trainee contract. But it isn't the national trainee contract because they are locally employed doctors. And as a result, trusts can largely do what they like with those contracts, which is why certainly during the CT3 equivalent year, a lot of doctors reported that they had less study leave or had difficulty accessing study budgets. They recognised that actually their trusts weren't necessarily playing fair. And I think there are a number of doctors who find themselves in these locally employed doctor roles where they discover that their contracts aren't necessarily what they perhaps thought they were at the point where they signed up. Counter to that, the national SAS contracts are national. They were negotiated fairly recently. The new contract structure was released in 2021 in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, and 2022 in Scotland. These are nationally negotiated contracts agreed by the BMA and employment side. Unlike the locally employed doctor type jobs, they give you a right to a job plan, they give you a right to SPA time, and there is pay progression and an expectation of career development and career progression built into the contract structure. There are a lot of reasons why it would be advantageous to be a specialty doctor over being a long-term trust doctor.
As someone who was an F3 or a junior clinical fellow, I knew a lot of other people who did an F3, did a similar sort of junior clinical fellow year, but we had very, very different, you know, as you said, access to study leave budgets, as well as, you know, study leave time, as you mentioned. And I mean, in my opinion, there definitely seems to be a necessity for a national sort of contract, particularly at that level, which is, I guess, what you've described, or what we are describing with the specialty doctor contracts. Why do you think there's such a barrier to implementing this contract nationally?
There's several answers to that, and some of them are kinder than others. So part of the reason is ignorance. And I we've already alluded to the fact that prior to reading my tweets, you hadn't necessarily got a handle on even the existence of the SaaS contracts. You're not unique in that. And sadly, that is true not only of doctors who might benefit from arguing that they should be on a SaaS contract, it's also true of employers. So the majority of departments are run by clinical directors who are consultants who've never been a SaaS doctor. Mm-hmm. The majority of medical HR professionals have far more of a handle on what a trainee is and what a consultant is than what a specialty doctor or a specialist is. And that is a barrier to the right things happening. Being marginally less charitable, you can save money off the back of people who don't know what contract they should be on. You can deny people things that have been negotiated nationally by putting them on local terms and conditions of service. And I wish it weren't true, but there are some very exploitative practices going on out there. I'd also add that the majority of SaaS and locally employed doctors, up until recently, and it's still true now, are international medical graduates, which means that doctors are coming into the UK and rather than being offered the national contract for their work are being offered something non-standard. The number of British doctors outside of formal training has risen quite considerably, and I think we are seeing a little bit of a sea change. Some of the conversations we're having now are perhaps because it's impacting doctors who have come out of British medical schools. I wish that weren't the case, mm-hmm. but I think it is.
So, I mean, you've touched on a lot of issues there in terms of particularly for international medical graduates. And I think from my experience with the limited number of SAS doctors I have worked with, they all have tended to be international medical graduates. And as you've touched upon, it's an area which unfortunately does have some exploitation in that sense. Are there any resources you can guide people towards in terms of understanding their rights or in terms of, you know, if they do feel like they're being sort of hard done by the contract they're on, what can they do?
Well, there are some national resources you can definitely access. I would steer people towards the BMA website and to engage with their local BMA representatives and their trust local negotiating committee. I have to put in a shameless plug at this point for the updated SaaS handbook, which is being published by the Association SaaS Committee. We're hoping to get that out for SaaS Week at the beginning of October. So that contains, obviously we're not a trade union, so the association, it doesn't necessarily provide contractual advice, but there is some fairly no-nonsense explanations of what the different contracts are and what they mean to empower people with a bit of knowledge so they can take that back to their employers. There also should be people within any given organisation who exist to support and represent SaaS doctors. So every organisation should have a SaaS tutor. Every organisation should have a SaaS representative on their local negotiating committee. Some local negotiating committees now also have a locally employed doctor representative. And there is a new role that was described by the new contract reform, the most recent contract reform, which is the SaaS advocate role. Many trusts in England now have a SaaS advocate. And those SaaS advocates belong to a network where they get advice from a certain bearded anaesthetist. there are multiple people within your organisation who should be there to support you. And obviously nationally there are the SaaS committees at both the association and the college who are very, very keen to provide our support to doctors who find themselves outside of a formal training programme. The college are very inclusive of locally employed doctors on their SaaS committee. The association, we try and have a chat about where the right place for advice should come from, whether it would be from the SaaS committee or from the trainee committee, depending on the doctor's individual circumstances and where they are in their own career path.
Mm-hmm. So specifically talking about anaesthetics now, we're facing quite a well-documented recruitment crisis, particularly at ST4 level, with hundreds of anaesthetists who have completed core training unable to progress with a formal training pathway. Do you think SaaS has a role in helping these people?
I think SaaS is the answer, mm-hmm. personally. I appreciate I have a massive bias and therefore that was a fairly inevitable conclusion for me to draw. But in order to become a specialty doctor, you need 4 years postgraduate experience, 2 in anaesthesia, ideally in a formal training programme. The entire cohort stuck at that bottleneck all meet the eligibility to be specialty doctors. At the moment, the single biggest barrier to them choosing a SaaS career is they don't know what a SaaS career is supposed to look mm-hmm. like, and certain preconceptions about service roles and being stuck as a perpetual middle grade, and I hate the term middle grade, but that is a term that you still hear bandied around, prevents people from wanting to choose it. I would also say that another barrier is that employers are not advertising specialty doctor roles, they're advertising trust doctor, clinical fellow roles, so people have 1 year of stability and then they have to move on or they have to figure out what they're doing next. I think we are missing a trick, personally. I think clinical directors around the country should be pushing for the creation of a large number of specialty doctors in anaesthesia, because I think without a truly eye-watering expansion of the number of training numbers, the majority of doctors are not going to be an ST4 next year or the year after, unless we do something. And we need more training numbers. We desperately need more training numbers. But for anyone who doesn't have one, or for anyone who doesn't want one, there is a viable, a potentially very attractive alternative career to be had as a specialty doctor. And at the moment, I just don't think we are doing the right things. And I think we genuinely could solve this problem almost overnight with a little bit of cultural change.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So sort of continuing on with that theme, many people see SAS as a potential pathway to CESA. Is this something you've previously considered, and how viable of an option do you think this is?
So, yes, is there, in the simple answer, yes. After I left training, I wasn't done progressing my career. I've always seen being a specialty doctor as a route to continue my ongoing professional development and continuing progression towards greater seniority. I've never been defined by my badge. When my kids were both at primary school, I decided that I wanted to try and finish the FRCA. So having not completed the FRCA as a trainee, I then did complete the FRCA mm-hmm. when I was a specialty doctor. And then I was somewhat, my efforts to CESR sadly were then somewhat derailed by a combination of a curriculum change and a pandemic. Yeah. So my career has been impacted by these things in the same way an awful lot of the cohort of trainees' careers have been impacted by these things, sadly. At the point where it was becoming apparent to me, though, that I was unlikely to be able to achieve CESR, certainly not against the old curriculum, the contract change happened and the specialist role was restored. So it became apparent to me that I was already a specialist. I was already a senior SAS doctor. And I kind of opted to try and progress my career in a different way. I don't know where my career will end yet. I may be a specialist for the rest of my career. I may at some point endeavour to try and undertake CESR, but I don't know. I genuinely don't know. Yeah. The other thing I would say, and for anyone who's interested, is that there is a legislative change coming this year. So CESR currently contains an extraordinarily large amount of logistical barriers. It is achievable. People do achieve mm-hmm. it. But the volume of evidence that's required to prove that you are capable of becoming a consultant, to prove that you're capable of getting on the specialist register, is truly eye-watering. And yeah. the current submission for CESR is well over 1,500 pages commonly.
Yeah.
And I think the GMC recognise that that's a bit daft. So there is a legislative change coming in November, which in theory will make it not more straightforward. The standard will be maintained. No one has any desire to make it easier, in inverted commas, to become a consultant. But it will be, the processes will be streamlined in order to make it an appropriate burden of evidence, so that people who deserve to be on the specialist register can get there. I think there are positive things coming.
Mm-hmm. And again, going on from that, what I am noticing is an increase in job advertisements for trusts that seems to be running their own CESR program, not just where I work, but sort of up and down across the country. It seems to potentially be in response to the recruitment crisis we are facing. What are your opinions on this? Do you think it's a viable sort of future option?
There are positives and there are not so positives. Mm-hmm. I am very much in favour of anything that sees doctors having the ability and the opportunity to progress. Mm-hmm. Often these CESR fellowships are 3-year or 4-year fixed term locally employed doctor posts, with some of the pitfalls associated with being a locally employed doctor that we've already discussed. I'm a little concerned about what happens to people who don't meet the milestones. So if you are post FRCA, for example, then it is only the clinical milestones you have to meet. But some of these processes are recruiting doctors with an expectation that they will complete the FRCA, and I don't know what happens to them if they don't. So I am positive, because I think they are a reaction to the fact that we have a shortfall of training numbers, and they will allow some doctors to achieve their career goals, and I'm always in favour of that. But I personally think that we should be opening up support for CESR to anyone who is employed as a specialty doctor. I don't think these need to be standalone jobs, and I think if we made it more viable for people to choose to progress their careers at their own pace in a specialty doctor role, we would take some of the pressure off people. Because at the moment we're making people basically try for ST4, but mm-hmm. if you can't get an ST4 number, you can do something for 4 years that looks like you've got an ST4 number. I think we could be cleverer than that. I think we could give people the opportunity to progress in ways that better suit them over potentially a longer period of time, and take some of the stress out of progressing your career. While still potentially down the line achieving your career goal, be it becoming a specialist or becoming a consultant, either via TESR or via re-entering a training programme somewhere down the line. And at the moment, I don't think we do some of these things as well as we might.
So for those listening and probably aren't really aware of sort of a specialist doctor job plan, would you mind just running through what your day-to-day looks like, what your on-call commitments are, etc., that kind of thing?
Oh, certainly. So I have only fairly recently become a specialist, so my job is still somewhat taking its final form. What I would say, the difference between a specialty doctor and a specialist, one of the key differences is that a specialty doctor is expected to work independently. So within your clinical niche, you should be an independent expert, and within my clinical niche is obstetric anaesthetics primarily. So I have my own day on labour suite. Other days on labour suite are covered by a consultant colleague. I fill that gap on my day on labour suite. I also have an interest in regional anaesthesia, and I have another fixed list doing some major orthopaedics. And I'm fairly flexible with the rest of my current workload. I have a comparable amount of SPA time to my consultant colleagues for the roles that I undertake. So being a specialist is not detrimental to the amount that I'm paid for my non-clinical work. Out of hours at the moment, I cover labour suite at the weekend as a resident senior person on labour suite. Some of my colleagues who are specialists are still contributing to an out-of-hours resident rota, but there are some conversations about what that looks like going forward, because ideally the specialist role and the specialty doctor role should be distinct from one another. So specialists should be undertaking, their role should be different to the specialty doctor they were beforehand. I think some of these things are still being ironed out. Some organisations are advertising specialist posts where, exactly as I've described, there is daytime activity and weekend activity, be it obstetrics, trauma, emergencies, but no out-of-hours component at all. I think those doctors are quite lucky. That's only my role at the moment, because I'm currently going through an occupational health process, otherwise I would be on an out-of-hours rota. I think for a lot of specialists, it might mean either continuing to work on a resident out-of-hours rota, but potentially at a reduced frequency in comparison to trainee or specialty doctor colleagues. And for a subset of specialists, it may involve progressing to being on a consultant non-resident on-call rota. Mm-hmm. There have always been associate specialists in anaesthesia who functioned as consultants out of hours as well as during the day. These doctors have existed, this isn't new. And for a group of specialists, that will be their future. They will be specialists, but they won't be on the specialist register, but they will work largely as consultants, even out of hours. I don't believe that will ever be the majority. And I think hopefully the changes to CESR would allow some of those doctors to in fact become consultants, because in my opinion, the specialist role is supposed to be an expert in a smaller niche than a consultant colleague. Mm. And if you're functioning as a consultant, you ought to get paid as one and have the badge. Yeah. that's my opinion. Yeah. I think defining these roles is probably important. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. So finally, for those who have listened to this podcast and are now interested in a career, an SAS career, would you be able to point them towards any sort of available resources which could give them more information about it?
Absolutely. So I would reiterate my shameless plug for the SAS handbook. I think Dr. Wayne would be very cross with me if I didn't try and sell that. I think the SAS handbook actually has an enormous amount of useful information for doctors, both who are contemplating a SAS career or who work with SAS doctors. I think there's a lot of stuff in there that's very valuable, regardless of what your own personal career goals and career pathway looks like. I'd also say that, you know, if you are interested in SAS careers, following me on social media probably wouldn't be the worst idea. And there are resources on the Royal College website, there are other resources on our website, and there's a huge amount of resource on the Academy of Medical Royal College website. Mm-hmm. So the AOMRC SAS committee have been very, very engaged and very active in recent years, and there have been a large number of documents describing kind of what's supposed to happen for a SAS doctor, how to broaden your role into the non-clinical, how to get involved in education, how to get involved in research or leadership or management. There are papers on a lot of these things. And that's an excellent place to start too.
Brilliant. So I think that's probably all we have time for. Thanks a lot, Rob, for joining me today. Hopefully we've broadened your horizons, let's say, in terms of the possible careers for anaesthetists. So again, from Annual Congress in Edinburgh, thank you for listening.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.